I guess in terms of material assigned, I have one of the shortest assignments in all of lectureship. It's just one phrase. What are the new heavens and the new earth of Isaiah 65, verse 17? The prophet on behalf of God said in this passage, "Behold, I create a new heaven, or new heavens and a new earth." Now there's a repetition of this promise, reference to it, in chapter 66, almost the closing words of Isaiah's book, in verse 22. There are two other appearances of this expression, new heavens and a new earth, both of which are in the New Testament. And we cannot study these two Old Testament passages without referring to and studying along with them the two New Testament passages. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 13 in the context of the coming of the Lord and the end of all things and that sort of thing. The new heavens and the new earth are mentioned. And then as John is drawing his great revelation to a close in chapter 21 and verse 1, he refers to the new heavens and the new earth. Now, what does John, or what does Isaiah refer to in his passages, in his references to the new heavens and the new earth, is our question. Are we to take these figuratively, or are they to be taken literally as promises to Israel? Are they promises to the Israelites who will be in exile, but who will be returned to their homeland after the captivity? Are these promises that are, as the millennialists aver, to be fulfilled in a literal millennial kingdom of Christ upon the earth? Are these promises to be fulfilled in the Max King AD 70 view of Scripture and prophecy and the destruction of Jerusalem and heaven and hell, the end of all things? Are these prophecies of Isaiah a reference to heaven itself? Are these prophecies a reference to the Christian age, to Christ and his glorious messianic kingdom, the church upon the earth? All of these have been suggested as possibilities for the meaning of what Isaiah says in prophesying the new heavens and the new earth. We'll proceed in our study tonight by eliminating one by one those that I do not believe are the correct understanding of Isaiah's prophecies, and then spend the remainder of our time on what I believe he has in mind. Was this prophecy, first of all, to be literally fulfilled upon the return of Israel to her homeland? The section of Isaiah we have been studying this week, the final section of the book, the last 27 chapters beginning in chapter 40, consists of words of comfort and hope to God's people while they would be in captivity. First among these words of comfort is the promise of the eventual end of the captivity itself and the literal restoration of a remnant of Israel, which will actually be Judah and Israel reunited during the captivity, but all as one now being brought back to their homeland. Interwoven with the restoration prophecies are the dramatic prophetic descriptions of the suffering servant that God was going to send. And there are several references to this servant in the book of Isaiah. Chapter 53 is devoted entirely to him. But this servant of Jehovah would usher in a glorious messianic age. And with ushering it in, we have the principal subject of the final seven chapters of the book, beginning chapter 60. The new heavens and the new earth promise is a part of that final section of the book concerning the messianic age and the suffering servant that the Lord would send to inaugurate it. Hence, the promise of the new heavens and the new earth is no more to be taken as a literal promise to be fulfilled to the returned Jews as a part of their repatriation than is the New Jerusalem, which is also in this immediate context, beginning in verse 18 of chapter 65. We'll say more about the New Jerusalem a little bit later if we have time. So first of all, we eliminate a literal fulfillment to the literal nation or remnant of the Jewish nation that would be brought back from the captivity to their homeland. Well, is it to be fulfilled in a literal millennial reign of the Messiah on earth? John Peter Lang and other premillennial commentators see in the promises that Isaiah gives in chapter 65 and 66 of the new heavens and the new earth, and of those two passages referring to it in the New Testament, a reference to their literal millennial kingdom concept. Perhaps never has a more intricate, anti-biblical, convoluted, ill-conceived system of theology been invented than the premillennial and dispensational systems. It is not a doctrine, as brethren sometimes refer to it. It is a system of theology. It is a set of looking glasses through which one looks, and everything he sees in the Bible is colored by those glasses. And there are those who say that the new heavens and the new earth most definitely refer to that. Generally, adherents of this system, which includes almost all of Protestant denominationalism, hold to the following broad outline of doctrine, though they differ among themselves in some of the sub-points of it. We'll just summarize it in 5 points for sake of time. One, the Old Testament prophets foretold a literal kingdom which was to be established and ruled over by a son of David, the Messiah. Two, Jesus was that Messiah who attempted to establish such a kingdom, but he was thwarted by the Jews who rejected and crucified him. Three, God had not anticipated or planned on this eventuality. It caught him by surprise, caught him off guard. And so, on the spur of the moment, he came up with the church to serve as a substitute for the kingdom until he could send his son a second time, upon which time he would then establish that kingdom. Then number four, when the Lord returns, he will then set up that kingdom. It will be a literal political entity upon the face of the earth, and it will stand for 1,000 years. Fifth, this alleged literal 1,000-year reign will take place in a literal new heavens and a new earth that God will institute. Now, this theological labyrinth is utterly false in every major point, as seen by the following simple references to Scripture. Number one, the Old Testament prophets never indicated that the new kingdom of David's son was to be a literal kingdom. In fact, if the Jews had read their prophets carefully, they would have seen the impossibility of its being a literal kingdom. When God gave the promise to David in 2 Samuel 7, 12, 13, and 16, he said it would be a kingdom that would have no end. You don't have any things on the earth, literally speaking, that have no end. When Daniel prophesied of it in chapter 2, verse 44 of his book, he said it was a kingdom, again, that would have no end and would stand forever. There is no piece of candy on the face of the earth that has no end. Every piece of candy, sooner or later, is all licked up. It plays out, as does everything else on the face of the earth, including all of the kingdoms. Jesus, number two, did not come to establish an earthly kingdom. That's made so plain. John 6:15, the Jews tried to force a crown of a literal kingdom upon his head, and he fled from them rather than take it. In Pilate's court, he said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from hence." John 18, verse 36. Number three, we know that this could not be so because the church is by no means an afterthought on the part of God. It is according to his eternal purpose, which he purposed in Christ Jesus our Lord. Ephesians 3, 10 and 11. The church is not a substitute for the kingdom. It is the kingdom. In fact, the church is not a substitute for anything. It is in God's all time and even before time plan for the redemption of mankind. Moreover, it is blasphemous, even as it is untrue, to even suggest that God neither knew nor expected his son to be rejected when he sent him into this world. Was it not Isaiah in chapter 53 that said, "He was despised and rejected of men"? Oh, yes, God knew what would happen to his son. But he established his church, his kingdom, anyway, the kind of kingdom that God sent him to establish. Number four, when the Lord returns, it will not to be set up, not be to set up a new kingdom, but to deliver up his existing kingdom, which is the church, according to 1 Corinthians 15, verses 20 through 24. A 1,000-year reign is mentioned twice in the Bible, both of them in Revelation chapter 20, verses 4 and 6. The 1,000-year reference appears in a book full of symbols and signs, many of which are stated numerically. It is in a context filled with figurative terminology, the first 8 verses of Revelation chapter 20. Yet this tiny tale is allowed to wag the entire theological dog of the premillennialist and dispensationalist. Everything is built around the 1,000-year reign in their outlook on the Bible. Now, since the entire millennial system is scripturally bankrupt and materialistic to the core, and nothing more than the vain speculations of overworked imaginations, it is obvious that this could not have been what Isaiah had in mind when God told him that he was going to create new heavens and a new earth. Well, is Isaiah's prophecy to be fulfilled in Max King's speculations? One of the few systems of theology of which I'm aware that may equal in its convoluted doctrinal maze equal the convoluted doctrinal maze of premillennialism is the doctrine of Max King and the AD 70 heresy that he spouts. Max King came out of Warren, Ohio. I guess he's still in Warren, Ohio, a number of years ago, back in the 70s, introduced his doctrine at Fried Hardeman Lectures. He had just published a book on it. And I was at the lectureship, I think maybe David was too, when this was introduced. And Brother Gus Nichols, I well remember, stood on the platform in the old Bader Gymnasium and begged with great tears flowing down his cheeks to Brother King sitting in the audience and his father-in-law with him, from which he got his doctrine, "Please do not let this book be circulated. It will destroy a number of brethren. It will destroy churches and so forth, destroy the faith of people." And he first said it ought to be thrown in the river, and then he said, "No, I'll take that back. You ought to burn this book. Somebody might fish it out of the river downstream. This book needs to be destroyed." Well, Max King did not heed that sage advice, and he has gone deeper and deeper into this doctrine. Now, we haven't time to give a lot of attention to this, but let me just mention some of the salient points of Kingism, as it is sometimes called, the AD 70 doctrine. Actually, it's a system of theology too, just as much as premillennialism is. Here's some of the salient points. The final second coming of Christ occurred when Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. Thus, all of the promises and prophecies concerning the second coming were fulfilled in that event. Indeed, the system avers that all previously unfulfilled prophecies of every kind were fulfilled either before or by AD 70. There is no prophecy yet to be fulfilled. Based on the above premise, AD 70 devotees have concluded that, number one, the final resurrection occurred in AD 70. But they spiritualize that and say that that was the resurrection of the church, because Judaism, its main persecutor, was destroyed, you see, so the church could be resurrected. They say the final judgment occurred in AD 70. That is, God's judgment upon corrupt Judaism. That's what they think the final judgment was. They say, in the third place, the world ended in AD 70. That is, the world that was destroyed was Judaism. That's what they call the world in that context. They say the new heavens and the new earth were ushered in upon the destruction of the world, Jerusalem, in AD 70, and there will be no future new heavens and new earth. Hence, it must follow that the eternal rewards for all men of either heaven or hell were announced and set in AD 70, and everyone is now in one or the other, in heaven or hell, while we here and now live. Now, I know for some of you who've never heard of this doctrine before, you're thinking, who in the world would ever believe that? But amazingly, it has caught the fancy and attention of many brethren. But the new heavens and the new earth, according to King and his followers, refers to the earth upon which we now live, which is also heaven, the eternal abode of the righteous. Now, the only thing more incredible than the system of theology is that anyone would believe it. And yet it does seem that the number of adherents to any religious doctrine or practice increases in direct proportion to the degree to which it is not in the Bible. People will believe almost anything as long as it's not in the Bible. And that surely serves well for this doctrine. Now, while it is true that a coming of Christ in judgment occurred upon the nation of Israel in A.D. 70, which Jesus said was going to happen in Matthew 24, 29 through 34, the second coming of Christ did not occur then, and at this very moment it still has not occurred. And that may happen before we get out of here tonight, but it hasn't occurred yet, or we wouldn't be here. The king in A.D. 70 heresy makes the fatal mistake of applying all of Matthew 24 to the destruction of Jerusalem, even as the premillennialist makes the fatal mistake of applying all of Matthew 24 to the second coming of Christ. However, the Lord clearly divides his prophecies in Matthew 24 into two sections. Those things which would occur before the passing of his own generation, namely the destruction of Jerusalem and the signs that would precede it, verses 4 through 34. And then secondly, those things which pertain to his second and final coming, the day and hour of which no angel, no man knows, and at the time he spoke the prophecy in Matthew 24, he himself did not know. There are no signs for that coming. We have to be ready all of the time, verses 35 through 51. When he comes again, nobody will have to doubt what has happened or that it has happened. He will come in a literal personal appearance comparable to his first coming, John chapter 14 verse 3 and several other passages. It will be a coming which every eye shall see, Revelation 1 verse 7. These elements were in no way true of his figurative coming in destruction upon the city of Jerusalem. Further, the following things did not occur in AD 70 as well. Number one, the general universal bodily resurrection of the dead did not occur. All humans since Adam who have lived and have since died except the Christ are still dead, and they'll be dead until the great resurrection occurs. That general resurrection occurs after the Lord comes again to bring judgment upon all mankind, and we haven't time to even speak the citations. Just look at the book. It is obvious to all rational individuals that the universal judgment described in the New Testament has not occurred. So it is still in the future, as well as the resurrection. The entire material universe, not merely old Jerusalem, is going to be destroyed. It will utterly pass away, be dissolved, be burned up. The elements even will melt with fervent heat when the Lord comes again. Since we still live in this material universe, it seems rather obvious that its destruction is yet in the future. The new heavens and a new earth described by Peter and John in the very context of the utter destruction of all of the material universe, 2 Peter chapter 3, will be the habitation of the saints only after the coming of the Lord, the resurrection of the dead, and the destruction of this old world and universe. Thus, the new heavens and the new earth described by Peter and John are still to come in the future. It is also obvious that saints are not now in heaven, and sinners are not now in hell, unless one adopts the ridiculous premise that heaven and hell are merely spiritualized, figurative concepts rather than actual, eternal habitations of the souls of men. But if we take that position, brethren and friends, we have undercut one of the very supporting pillars of the faith, that is, rewards and punishments in the afterlife. It amounts to a denial of the faith to hold such a position. If we can understand and believe anything the Bible teaches, heaven and hell are real places. Now, if the present existence of Christians is in heaven, then God must have either been unable or unwilling to fulfill his promises concerning it, or he must be a celestial, practical jokester. God's faithful ones are still in a world that is subject to death. It's overburdened with sin, with wicked men, with temptation, with suffering, with tears, with heartaches. But the heaven of Scripture will have none of these elements. God must have also been either unwilling or unable to fulfill his promises to those who refuse to serve him. Their present existence is not one of perpetual pain and torment and tears, which will be their eternal lot in the biblical hell. but one in which many positive elements are present for them. Then do we wonder why others prosper, living so wicked year after year? The wicked often prosper far beyond the righteous in this world. Eternal heaven and hell are the literal future respective abodes of the righteous and the unrighteous. I believe the new heavens and the new earth, as referred to by Peter and John, are a description of the glorified church in heaven itself, as I hope to soon demonstrate. Their new heavens and a new earth is most certainly not the heaven conjured up by the AD 70 speculators. Most definitely, God's people are not now in heaven. Well, are Isaiah's new heaven and new earth a reference to the eternal abode of the righteous? We've already stated, we believe, that Peter and John are so referring. But what about Isaiah? It's common for expositors and expositors that we have great confidence in to identify Isaiah's new heavens and a new earth with those mentioned by Peter and John. But I do not believe that they are to be identified with each other. I believe the two places mentioned in the New Testament, or the two places where in the New Testament the new heavens and the new earth are mentioned, refer to the same place. I also believe that the two places where Isaiah refers to the new heavens and the new earth refer to the same place, but not the same place that Peter and John refer to. A comparison of the larger context of Isaiah with the descriptions given of the new heavens and the new earth by Peter and John in the New Testament lead me to make a distinction between them. In fact, they prevent me from making a connection between them. Now, both Isaiah and John say that weeping will cease in the new universe, the new heavens and the new earth. But Isaiah says in his model of the new heavens and new earth, there will still be death and sin. Verses 19 through 20 of Isaiah 65. In the model given by Peter and John, absolute life and righteousness will prevail because sin and all sinners will be forever banished along with death itself. And I'm unable to see then how Isaiah could be referring to heaven, the final abode of the soul, when he says that sin and death will still be present in the new heavens and the new earth that he speaks of. Since Peter and John both refer to heaven, or the heavenly state of the church, and the new heavens and the new earth phrase, then I want us to look for something else to which Isaiah refers. We'll spend the balance of our time now, about 10 minutes, trying to set forth why I believe that the correct interpretation of Isaiah's prophecies have to do with the Christian age, the church, the messianic reign of Christ upon this earth. The church upon this earth, not the messianic reign upon this earth. First of all, the immediately preceding context leads me to this. In Isaiah chapter 65, the very beginning of it has the great prophecy of the calling of the Gentiles. Now, this is not merely my view of the prophecy. It is what Paul says the meaning of Isaiah's prophecy was in Romans chapter 10, verse 20. He quotes it and refers it to the gospel's call to the Gentiles. Paul then dropped back to what God had to do to Israel as a nation because of her sins, verse 21. To prove his case then, he quoted Isaiah 65, verse 2. See, this is the chapter we're in Isaiah. Verse 17 is where the new heavens and the new earth context is. I have spread out my hands all the day unto a rebellious people that walk in a way that is not good after their own thoughts. Then in verses 2 through 7, we see the description of the iniquities of Israel, because of which God had to cast them off as his people and send them away into captivity until they learned better. However, he would spare a remnant that he might bring forth a seed out of Jacob, verses 8 and 9 of Isaiah 65, if you're following. So as to fulfill the Abrahamic promise, only a remnant did return from the captivity, as Bible students know, to inhabit the old homeland again, and Israel never regained real independent national status. Out of that physical remnant from the captivity, the baby Jesus, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, was born. Now the seed out of Jacob and the inheritor of God's mountains out of Judah, also in Isaiah 65, verse 9, are called God's chosen or elect and his servants. It is these very ones whom Paul calls the remnant according to the election of grace. In Romans 11, it should be. I had chapter 10 in my book, in my manuscript, and it's in the book that way. Page 349, if you want to correct it. It's Romans chapter 11, verses 5 through 7, 5 and 7. What is this describing? It is a description of those few Jews who believed on and obeyed the Christ, this spiritual remnant that came out of the physical remnant of Israel, therefore. Thus again, we see that Isaiah is describing things pertaining to the church and the Christian age when he speaks of this new heavens and a new earth that God is going to create. Verses 11, 16, which immediately precede the promise of the new heavens and new earth, is a description of the stark contrast between the faithful remnant who seek God in verse 10 and those who forsake him in verse 11. We jump down now to verse 17. It is unarguable that the promise of the new heavens and the new earth flows out of the material preceding it, all of which relates to the coming of the gospel, the coming of the Christ, the remnant that would come out of Israel to be the spiritual Israel. And the new heavens and the new earth is simply a phrase then describing man's total environment, his universe. It will be a spiritual environment and universe, the church of the living God. Of course, Isaiah's new heavens and a new earth does not refer to a physical environment like the heavens and earth that we have here that will all pass away when the Lord comes again. But it is the atmosphere in which he will be able to live spiritually when that suffering servant, that Messiah of God, comes into the world. If my analysis of Isaiah 65, 1 through 16 is correct, then verse 17 necessarily refers to the glorious new Christian system, the kingdom church of Christ, in contrast to the old Mosaical system. And then the immediately succeeding context leads us to this conclusion as well. Now, this is a highly figurative section, as much of Isaiah is. We're talking about descriptions here of things that are going to be figurative. They're not things that are going to take place with literal fulfillment. Isaiah 65:18 speaks of a rejoicing Jerusalem, which God will create in his new heavens and new earth. Well, this new Jerusalem is not the old literal city that's going to be revived when Israel returns from her captivity. It is actually not a city at all, but verses 18 and 19 of Isaiah 65 show that it is a people who belong to God. Also remind us that the church on earth is described in the New Testament as a figurative Jerusalem in Hebrews 12, 22 and 23. In verse 25 of Isaiah 65, we have a clear link between the new heavens and the new earth and the Christian age. The description of the peace between wild and domesticated animals, which are normally mortal enemies, such as the wolf and the lamb, is but an abbreviated repetition of Isaiah 11, verses 6 through 9. If we can determine the meaning of Isaiah's further description and fuller description in Isaiah 11, we can know what he referred to in chapter 65, verse 25. Paul again helps us here by quoting Isaiah 11, verse 10, and declaring that the events described therein refer to events being fulfilled in the Christian age. Romans 15, verse 12. Now, the future kingdom millennialists love to take Romans 11 and say that this is a description where the wild animals and the domesticated animals, who normally are mortal enemies, they lie down with one another and they're at peace with one another and so forth. This is the millennial kingdom that's being described. However, those who respect the word of the inspired interpreter Paul have no choice but to see in it a glorious figurative description of Messiah's rule in his church, his kingdom. In Isaiah 11, we have the coming, identity, qualifications, and the work of Christ in verses 1 through 5 and 10, the preaching of the gospel to all the nations in verses 9 and 10, and the conditions that would and do prevail in God's holy mountain, his church, when men fully submit their wills to him. Now, there's another clear link between Isaiah 65 25 and Isaiah 11. In the concluding words of Isaiah 65, verse 25, is the following phrase: "They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain," which is a verbatim repetition of Isaiah 11, verse 9a. Once more, if Isaiah 11 is fulfilled in the coming of the Messiah and the Christian age he ushered in, and it is, then we must likewise apply Isaiah 65:25 to the Christian age. Since 65:25 is but a part of the contextual description of the new heavens and the new earth, verse 17 appears in that same immediate context. I am compelled to conclude that the new heavens and the new earth of verse 17 is a figurative description of the Christian age, in which we have the glorious Church of Christ with all of the blessings common to it. Furthermore, God's holy mountain of chapter 65:25 must be identified with the mountain of Jehovah's house that was to be established and prophesied in chapter 2, verses 2 through 4 of Isaiah. This identity is made the more sure then by the reading of Hebrews chapter 12, 22, and 23, to which we've already referred. It is not then the old fleshly nation of Israel that will remain and will endure as recipients of the promises and choicest blessings of God, as many millions yet falsely believe and teach. They're not going to be brought back again to the nation of Israel. God does not owe fleshly Jews a single thing, not a square inch of ground. All of that was fulfilled. They have forfeited their right to be the people of God by the rejection of the very Son of God. The prophecies of Isaiah do not relate to fleshly Israel in that way concerning a future kingdom of the Messiah yet to come in any respect. It is rather the new heavens and a new earth, the church, the spiritual Israel of God, who have been so constituted by their obedience to the gospel of Christ, whose seed and name shall be perpetuated even to eternity. Isaiah 66 and verse 22. All who have obeyed the gospel can rejoice in the gracious provisions God has made for his spiritual Israel, which we can now enjoy in the church. I think we take so many things for granted as children of God, as those who are part of the glorious kingdom of Christ, his church. We ought to count our blessings and name them one by one that we have in the new heavens and the new earth, which constitute the church of the Lord in Isaiah's prophecy. These truly constitute a new universe, something that God created anew for mankind to bring people through his Son into heaven at last. Those who faithfully serve the Christ may joyously and longingly anticipate the everlasting new heavens and new earth, which will be their eternal abode, wherein dwelleth righteousness, and where God will wipe away all tears. These are Peter's and John's description of that final new heavens and new earth. I know that this has been somewhat technical, and it has not lent itself to the kind of preaching I ordinarily like to do, and yet I hope that I fulfill the assignment given me. Thank you very much.